listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 40th installment of our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the Soviet Union. And actually, we are now going to be moving into a look at the history of relations between the Soviet Union and China as the break between the two after Nikita Khrushchev turned the party around, the Communist Party around almost 180 degrees in the Soviet Union, caused a break with the Chinese Communist Party and some things that still echo today. Luciana, pleasure to have you.
My pleasure, as usual, Don. Yes, we were going to talk about the Sino-Soviet split, the break between the Soviet Communist Party and the Chinese Communist Party, which actually took a decade from 1956 to 1966. Right. And so it was a long period of tension, an unofficial break. When Khrushchev made his infamous secret report to closed doors to members, to delegates of the Communist Party in 1956, we talked about this. During this secret report, he de-Stalinized. He issued a de-Stalinization denunciation, and also announced peaceful coexistence with the capitalist West. So Mao Zedong reacted to these two turnarounds.
You know what? Let me give our audience. No, because our audience is a lot younger than I am, certainly, and didn't live through a lot of this stuff. What we're talking about is first Khrushchev, when he gave the speech condemning Stalin and the period of Stalin's governance in the Soviet Union. He was adopting essentially a line that had been the line of those opposed to the Soviet Union around the world that called themselves socialists or communists. It was the Trotsky line. It was also the line of other socialist parties that were opposed to the Soviet government and to the Soviet Union. Where they would break down generally these groups on foreign policy was they would side with the United States and the European imperial powers against the Soviet Union almost on each and every issue. It was couched in Marxist and socialist sounding rhetoric, but in essence, on the question of international relations, it was an anti-Soviet position. And now this was what was being taken by the leadership of the Soviet Union and also being introduced to the communist parties, the international, around the world. And China said, hello, wait a minute, what's going on here? So that's kind of the context for this that, you know, we've discussed in some depth earlier, but just so people understand
exactly
what we're picking
up. With the discussion in some depth earlier, they sort of stumped me now in terms of summary, but you're exactly right. The issue was that China asked, what's going on? Are we Marxist-Leninist, or what are we?
Right.
So this, in 1961, the Communist Party of China finally, and that would be, in 1961, denounced Khrushchev communism as the product of revisionist traitors.
Yep.
He called the clique around Khrushchev revisionist traitors. Now, in the West, this split was portrayed as a struggle for power. If you look at Wikipedia, for example, it says the Sino-Soviet split was about who would lead the revolution of world communism.
Right.
To whom China or Russia would the vanguard parties of the world turn for aid and assistance?
Right.
In that vein, the USSR and the PRC competed for ideological leadership through their respective networks of Communist Party, etc.
Right.
So this is portrayed in the West as a struggle for a single party's power over the world communism and world communist parties. This is completely wrong, because the struggle was over the nature of Marxist-Leninism.
Right.
As Mao explains in the letter that I want, from which I want to quote extensively today. So,
one other piece of context. Now, I hope this doesn't throw you a curve, but this is an interesting thing to consider also. We're talking about 1956. This is just after Bandung Conference, the rise of the non-aligned movement. We are a few years into the post-war decolonization period that's going on. There are anti-imperialist uprisings taking place in colonies across the world. And you have, in essence, first a competition between the socialist countries, which are anti-imperialist by the ideology, the Marxist ideology that we're discussing, or the imperialist or former imperialist powers that are spreading now decolonization and democracy. As if, here, you can now run your government. We just want to continue to own your stuff. Inside that context, if you look at the nature of imperialism in its history, it essentially comes from Europe and spreads across the world. And there was, at the same time that Khrushchev was talking about, let's forget about being anti-imperialist, let's do accommodation with the West, let's do peaceful coexistence, as the colonies were rising up themselves, China was saying, hey, you know what, we're not Europeans and neither are they, and we're with them. And so there was this racial dynamic to it, and a colonized aspect to it that was not even the background to it. It's just swimming in that context.
Yeah, exactly. At the we're talking, so 1956 to 1966 is the period of the break, but as you point out, the crucial events of the era were the efforts at decolonization. And so for the Khrushchev gang, as I call it, to call for peaceful coexistence when the imperialist power were anything but peaceful was in essence a betrayal of Lenin in particular, imperialism.
Right.
So in 56, Khrushchev launches demonization of Stalin, de-Stalinization crusade. And in 1961, which was the last time that China participated in the Congress of Communist Party in Moscow, it was really the symbolic break in 61. And so they reiterated in that Congress in 1961, the Soviet Communist Party, now under leadership of Khrushchev, reiterated the accusations and reinforced the accusation against Stalinism. And what Mao argued was that the Chinese Communist Party had consistently over this period between 1956 and 1961 had consistently maintained that the question of how to evaluate Stalin and what attitude to take towards him is just not one of appraising Stalin himself. More importantly, it was a question of how to sum up the historical experience of the dictatorship of the proletariat and of the international communist movement since Lenin's death. And this is what the Chinese party continued to insist on having clarified. That is, okay, you accuse Stalin, but what about the experience of the dictatorship of the proletariat? And during the 22nd Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the Sino-Soviet split therefore hardened, especially due to this de-Stalinization effort, and but the words of which were peaceful coexistence, the USSR is the state of all the people. In essence, Khrushchev was saying that there was no remnant of the class struggle in the Soviet Union, at the same time that he was actually conducting policies that split the industrial workers, that is the proletarians, from the agricultural workers by separating in municipal areas, you know, by forming committees for industrial workers and committees for agricultural workers, in effect, trying to establish two parties. Whereas, you know, the efforts of Lenin from the beginning had been to unite the two, because that's where the success of the revolution actually was in question. I mean, the unity of peasants and workers. And
right.
So at the same time that he was saying the class struggle is over and we are the Soviet Union is the state of all the people, he was actually forming these two, soliciting these two parties, sowing confusion and disorientation. And finally, of course, in 1964, he was pushed out of power. So on the question of Stalin, Mao wrote a open letter, which was published in the People's Daily of China. And this question of Stalin was a second comment on the open letter of the Central Committee of the Soviet Union soon after 1956. He had to write a second comment because the Soviet Union ignored the questions such as I have just summarized, and, you know, just continue to ignore it. So, and on the 31st of October of, I think, 1961, Stalin's body was removed from the Lenin mausoleum, and Stalin officially became a genocidal tyrant. So Mao's letter of 1964 spells out the consequences of this de-Stalinization, this second comment. So he says, as the train of events since the 20th Congress in 1956 fully show, the complete negation of Stalin by the leadership of the Soviet Union has had extremely serious consequences. The number one consequence has been that it has provided the imperialists, this is Mao writing, and the reactionaries of all countries with exceedingly welcome anti-Soviet and anti-communist ammunition. He writes that shortly after the 20th Congress, the imperialists exploited Khrushchev's secret anti-Stalin report to stir up worldwide tidal wave against the Soviet Union and against communism. So he also, I mean, Tito, this is my words now, Khrushchev accused Stalin of mocking up relations with Tito's Yugoslavia. At the same time, of course, Khrushchev is mocking up relations with Mao's China. So Mao says the imperialists, the reactionary of all countries, the Tito clique, and the opportunists of various descriptions all leapt at the chance to attack the Soviet Union, the Communist Party and the Socialist camp. So many fraternal parties and countries were placed in serious difficulties. That's the result, number one. The second result was that, I quote Mao, the frantic campaign against Stalin by the leadership of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union enabled the Trotskyites, who had long been political corpses, to come to life again and clamor for the rehabilitation of Trotsky. In November 1961, writes Mao, at the conclusion of the 22nd Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the International Secretariat of the so-called Fourth International, that is Trotsky's International, stated in a letter to the 22nd Congress that in 1937, Trotsky said, a monument would be erected to the honor of the victims of Stalin.
Right.
And Mao says that the Fourth International continued. Today, this prediction has come true.
Right.
Before your Congress, the first secretary of your party has promised the erection of this monument.
Yep.
So, as a matter of fact, I was going to start by saying this, by framing the whole discussion of the Sino-Soviet split with what happened last year in Russia. On October 10th, 2017, President Vladimir Putin inaugurated a monument to the victim of Stalinist purges. That wasn't his initiative. It was the initiative of some human rights Russians, a human rights group. But nevertheless, he attended, he attended this monument to the victims of Stalinist purges, which was called the Wall of Grief, and is placed on the outskirts of Moscow. And the Reuters reported this, saying that nearly 700,000 people were executed during the Great Terror of 37-38. And Reuters says, according to conservative official estimates, but those were the people who had been arrested.
Right.
So, you know, and Reuters then adds that, unfortunately, in their tone, monuments and memorial plaques honoring Stalin has sprung up in different Russian regions. State-approved textbooks have softened his image, and an opinion poll in June of 2017 crowned him the country's most outstanding historical figure. So what we see is, revisionism on one hand, that is Stalin the demon, victims, etc., and on the other hand, popular feelings turning towards the figure of Stalin. So, and we have to observe, too, that there are no monuments to the victims of Stalin in China that I know of. Do you?
That's right. And not only that, one really important point is, even though Mao's writing in, 1963, I guess, that we're reading from?
63, 64, yeah, it's hard to remember.
So he talks about that the demand made that Trotsky be, that the Trotsky's name be engraved on this monument. This is happening, you know, he's predicting that this monument will take, you know, be built back in 63, it is. And,
That's right.
And that's 10 years after Stalin died in 53. Okay, and it took until 2017 for them to actually build it. That's where the
real
public support is. It was 64 years after Stalin's death that Trotsky finally got his monument.
Sort of.
Okay.
He has failed to gain rehabilitation to this day, though.
That's right, of course. And it's also 26 years after the Soviet Union ceased to exist. It still took 26 years to do that.
Yeah. It's just, and then the third consequence that Mao enumerates is the all-out application of a revisionist line. This, the demonization of Stalin in the secret report led to a revisionism of Soviet history. So he writes, Stalin died in 53. 3 years later, the leaders of the Soviet Communist Party violently attacked him at the 20th Congress. And 8 years after his death, they again did so at the 22nd Congress in 61, removing and burning his remains. And he writes, continues to write, Mao, in repeating their violent attacks on Stalin, the leaders of the Soviet Communist Party aimed at erasing the indelible influence of this great proletarian revolutionary among the people of the Soviet Union and throughout the world, and paving the way for negating Marxism-Leninism, which Stalin had defended and developed, and thus initiate the season of all-out application of a revisionist line. Do you see how far-seeing supports what you just said. And this revisionism, of course, is the same as counter-revolution, that is, rewriting the history of the revolution in a Western what do you call it, acceptable way.
Well, it's a tactic of implementing a counter-revolution, in essence. I mean, what you're doing, in essence, is saying...
Yeah, and then you rewrite
history. You rewrite the history so that you can tell people, you know, all those things, you know, you lack this or you need that or whatever. It's not, because the capitalist countries have encircled us and had declared war on us at the beginning and all these other things, murdered tens of millions of us. It's because of Stalin. It's Stalin's fault.
Yeah.
So the things that you were holding dear to you that are the result of Stalin helping to organize a fight against these people that have been doing this to you, now listen to the people that were doing it. They're telling you Stalin's the bandit and that's what should happen. And guess what? The people didn't buy it because it took them 64 years to erect one single monument to those quote-unquote victims.
Yeah. And so their revisionist line, writes Mao, began exactly with the 20th Congress and became fully systematized at the 22nd Congress. The facts have shown ever more clearly that their revision of the Marxist-Leninist theories on imperialism, war and peace, proletarian revolution, and the dictatorship of the proletariat, revolution in the colonies, the semi-colonies, is inseparably connected with their complete negation of Stalin.
Right.
So the fourth, so much to say. The fourth consequence is also interesting, because this is probably the most important. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm going to intrude here with the thought that I had lost. It's also interesting that Stalin, who led victory against imperialist Germany, supported by... you know, the Western, before, by the Western powers, was then demonized. I mean, his reputation at the beginning of the Cold War, at the beginning of the Cold War, let's say, between 45 and 50, his reputation was high very much across the world.
Right.
So to denigrate him, to demonize him, was to play right in the hands of those cold warriors that were setting out to contain communism. It's interesting to see how, time-wise, Khrushchev's action dovetails with the intentions of the imperialist powers, at the head of which is the United States, to contain, which is a polite word of to destroy communism in the world.
Right.
So that's what I wanted to say, that this was important. The demonization of Stalin was important because Stalin was such a respected figure.
Yeah.
Up until 1953, up until his death, right?
Yep.
So then Mao goes on, and the fourth consequence, which is the most important for China, for communist parties all over the world, Mao writes, in launching the combat against the personality cult, the leaders of the Soviet Communist Party are not out to restore what they call, quote, the Leninist standard of party life and principles of leadership. He says, on the contrary, they are violating Lenin's teaching, and this is important, on the interrelationship of leaders, party, class, and masses, and contravening the principle of democratic centralism in the party. He explains this very clearly. He says this principle of democratic centralism. He says Marxist-Leninists maintain that if the Revolutionary Party of the Proletariat is genuinely to serve as the headquarters of the proletariat in struggle, it must correctly handle the interrelationship of leaders, party, class, and masses, and must be organized on the principle of democratic centralism. Such a party must have a fairly stable nucleus of leadership. This is Lenin,
yep,
arguing against Trotsky in 1903.
Right.
Such a party must have a fairly stable nucleus of leadership, which should consist of a group of long-tested leaders, right, who are good at integrating the universal truths of Marxism-Leninism with the concrete practice of revolution.
Right.
In other words, the party needs leaders not to lead the people, but to be in touch and to work with the people and to come out of their experience,
right,
and to know the philosophy, if you want to call it that, of Marxism-Leninism.
Right.
And just, I think this is so important that I want to quote some more. Mao writes that the leaders of the Proletarian Party, whether members of the central or local committees,
right,
emerge.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's saying they emerge from the masses in the course of class struggles and mass revolutionary movements.
Revolutionary movement.
Yeah. So you have, you know, basically, it's the people themselves. The leaders emerge, they are of the people, and they have the people's experience and consciousness and interests.
Yeah.
And so they're one with the people.
Gorbachev did not.
That's right. That's right.
People like Gorbachev and the new leaders, whom Lenin predicted would act like that.
Yep.
Because, so Khrushchev, at the same time that he was saying Stalin had become divorced from the people, look at what he's doing.
Not only that, you know, in this letter from Mao, from the Central Committee, but Mao clearly had, you know, was his hand, describes Khrushchev as he criticizes the cult of personality as inflating himself and having those around him inflate him with a fake history that is nothing but a personality cult, only without the actual credentials warranting it, rather just fictional public relations writing. We'll pick it up next week. I want to stay on this at least another work, and we'll pick it up again. Luciana, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you, and I'm really enjoying this.
Thank you, Don. My pleasure.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart Extra. This is in addition to our regular show in which we focus on the people behind the stories. If asked to name the most oppressive Soviet or Russian leader, Joseph Stalin is likely to be among the first to come up. The Great Terror of the 1930s still haunts this country, with millions executed or sent to the gulags. What is much less known is that barely a year before the purges began, Stalin sought to, well, for the lack of a better word, democratize the Soviet society, and the society pushed back against it. These paradoxes of Soviet power came to light thanks to the work of an American academic from Maryland, whom we found here in Northeast Russia, almost 9,000 kilometers away from the old line state.
So before we start reading this article, what I'd like to do is talk about popular fashions, hairstyles in Russia. So for girls, what is probably a really popular hairstyle?
Samantha Lom is an assistant professor at the Vyatka State University, who's been teaching here on and off for almost 6 years. In the morning, she's trying to expand her students' English vocabulary by discussing beauty and fashion. In the afternoon, she scours the local archives in search of documents which shed light on a much heavier subject, the early years of the Soviet state. I wouldn't be surprised to find a graduate from the Vyatka State University teaching at the University of Pittsburgh, but I think the opposite is still quite exotic. How did you end up here?
Well, I started writing my dissertation on the 1936 Constitution, and when I looked in the archives in Moscow, there was just an overwhelming amount of material. So I needed to focus on a region, and one of the regions I found a lot of material from was Kirov. funding was a little bit difficult to come by. It's not necessarily the most sexy topic.
You say it's not the most sexy topic, but I think it's a very counterintuitive topic on many levels. How did the idea pop into your
head
in the first place?
That's actually how I came to it. I'm like, Constitution and Stalin seem like two things that shouldn't go together. So I wanted to see what this was about, how serious a project this was, whether it was really just a propaganda exercise as it had been described, or if there was something a little bit more substantive to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Stalin era is one of the most extensively researched areas mm-hmm. of the Soviet history, and it's also the one that comes with a lot of accepted conventions. One is that this was a strictly totalitarian state where everything was decided top-bottom, and here you are coming out with a book suggesting that Stalin actually tried to encourage what he saw at least as genuine political participation. Why would he need something like that?
Well, Russia's very, very big, and at the time it had incredibly poor infrastructure and very few members of the Communist Party in rural areas to govern it. So governing the Tsarist Empire, the Soviet Union, and modern Russia has always been difficult simply because of the expanse and the fact that the population is not densely settled.
Now, Russia has a very peculiar relationship between people and power, and it's usually assumed that leadership suppresses the people's demands for rights. But I take it from your book that in the case of the 1936 Constitution, it was actually the other way around, that Stalin was actually more liberal and progressive than society could take it.
Yeah, I was quite surprised, too, when I was looking at particularly habeas corpus, which is the right to the ability to have rights when you stand trial, to not be arrested without the sanction of the procurator, etc. People were not interested in that. That was something that was designed as part of actually Vyshinsky's reforms to get away from this revolutionary legality and sort of the unequal implementation of both punishment and arrests. And people weren't interested. People had a lot of problems with crime in the countryside. And it tended to be crime that the state didn't prioritize. Things like drunken beatings, theft, hooliganism, that posed a real threat, arson, mm-hmm. to people's daily lives was deprioritized. So they wanted the ability to arrest people that destabilized their lives on the spot.
Now, you told me before that people in academia really advised you against using the word democracy mm-hmm. when it comes to Stalinist Russia, because they include this notion of civil society that is central to the idea of democracy. But what you're describing suggests that there wasn't totalitarianism at that point of time either. There was somebody in Moscow with a limited security apparatus, and the rest of the country was essentially lots of self-governance. Is that an accurate impression?
I think that totalitarianism, as in general, has sort of been debunked within academia simply because more regional studies have proved that they simply didn't have the manpower, the infrastructure to monitor people frequently. You know, I look at collective farms where they have seen district-level officials once every 1 or 2 years. So the rest of the time, they're busy doing whatever they want on their own.
People in the West would see Stalin's efforts to encourage this popular participation as a sham, because they would think that genuine democracy would be the impediment to his power. But from what you're saying, it may have been quite the opposite, that he saw it as a means of strengthening his power, simply because, again, as you said, he didn't have enough resources and enough manpower to reach to every little corner of Russia.
He actually gives an interview with Roy Howard in which he discusses his views on democracy. He sees it as a whip in the hands of the people to deal with incompetent local officials. He encourages them to be active, to root out those who are not doing a good job. You know, he says, you know, this person is not building a school, if this is dirty, if they are not, you know, providing you the services you need, tell us, vote this person out, because Moscow simply didn't have the resources to monitor every single, you know, district and region.
So there was this notion of political accountability.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very much so.
Now, I know that Stalin himself was the head of the Constitutional Commission. Mm-hmm. He personally worked on the drafts, making edits. I believe you studied some of those edits.
Yes, he has terrible handwriting.
Have you been able to draw any ideas about his own psychological profile based on things that he, you know, kept in and took out?
Not necessarily his psychological profile, but he tended to be more practical than the other drafters. The original draft was written by Yakovlev, Stetsky, and Thal, and it tends to include a lot of very ideological things. For example, there was a clause in there that parents should teach their children to hate capitalists. Mm-hmm. Stalin removes that because it's not really constitutional material. A lot of the things he pulled out tend to reappear in legislative initiative, things like the number of hours people should work, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
This constitution was adopted barely a year before the Great Terror, which saw millions of people either executed or sent to the gulags. And whenever this subject comes up in Russia, it always centers on Stalin, and much less so on the role that society at large played in allowing that to happen or even facilitating that whole process. Having spent so much time studying the correspondence between ordinary people and their leaders, do you think this progressive constitution offers any insight into the horrors that would follow directly after it?
Well, I know that the 1937 repression is one of the reasons that scholars often cite to delegitimize the Constitution. You know, as you mm-hmm. said, how can you be serious about democracy if you then turn around, violate everyone's mm-hmm. rights, and kill a bunch of people? My research has shown that certainly there were instances in the provinces of people using their new constitutional rights in ways that were threatening to the local power structure. Mm-hmm. So having these new locuses of power, people were asking to open up churches, people were collecting money to bring back priests. And so a lot of this is genuinely threatening to the locals, and so they certainly would like to get rid of them. And Arch Getty has postulated that you see a lot of pushback from the regional bosses who are threatened by the opening up of the 1936 Constitution, and that leads to repression.
How much is that process of repression driven from the center, and how much was it locally initiated?
Well, the thing is that the repression is sort of multi-pronged. You have, for example, actions against national minorities. That tends to be mostly KVD-driven because they already have catalogs of these people. They've been watching a lot of the national minorities, and those also tend to be related to national security issues, you know, particularly Poles, Koreans. In this area, people from the Baltic states are often monitored. But then you also have the center just simply giving large quotas of the numbers of people that need to be arrested, and they let the locals decide who fulfills that quota. But interestingly enough, by 1939 or 1940, most of them have had their sentence commuted, and they're back in another position of power.
Oh, that's interesting. I heard some Western scholars complain of the haphazard nature of access to the archives. I wonder if you needed any FSB clearance for that. Have you ever gotten suspected of being an American spy?
Well, people joke about it. I've been told that I'm a very nice spy.
Well, most of the spies are usually very nice. They have to get into good graces with people.
It's never been a problem in the archive. Part of it may be my topic. The Stalin Constitution isn't particularly political right now. And my current work focuses on collective farms, which, again, is not sensitive. If I was doing something on the secret police or even the Second World War, it may be a little bit different. But here they've been great with access.
Much of Samantha Lom's research focuses on the correspondence between the locals and the central authorities in Moscow, which was more direct than some would expect. While the newspapers of the time were filled with the praise of Soviet achievements, individual letters often focused on the failures.
We in Russia usually suffer from all the paperwork and the red tape mm-hmm. and the bureaucracy, but I assume you're one of the very few people who is actually benefiting from it.
Yes, if the Soviet Union didn't like to document everything, I wouldn't have anything to work with. Mm-hmm. And everything that they've documented lets me see various aspects of people's lives. For example, this fellow, Kataev Fyodor Fyodorovich, here in 1934, he's given a prize of 1,000 rubles for his good work. But later in 1936, he's considered a suspect person. So you can see how, you know, the standings change based on their successful implementation of economic plans, different changes in policy, and you can see, you know, these people's rise and fall in fortunes through these documents.
What is it like as a researcher to work with documents like this? I mean, would it be fair to describe them as a treasure trove, or is it something pretty mundane?
Well, I'm always excited by them. It's sometimes people think I'm odd because I'm like, oh my God, look at this beautiful document. And they're like, it's about harvest statistics.
Mm-hmm. Do you think anyone before you worked?
Oh, yeah.
Worked?
Oh, not on this one, but on this one. Mm-hmm. This is actually Larry. He's the guy that invited me to mm-hmm. Kirov, and mm-hmm. he, for his book on education, pulled these same documents. Mm-hmm. So you can see right here in the front, everybody who's worked on it, and even sometimes which pages they've used.
Mm-hmm. And it's only the Americans who come here and look at this
boring stuff. Well, no, this fellow is Russian mm-hmm. from 1979.
Listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Do we know the word infraction? An infraction is some way that you break the rule. Like you can have a speeding infraction if you drive too fast. So it's some sort of violation of a rule.
Having a native English speaker is both a rarity and a curiosity for a provincial Russian university. Samantha's classes also reveal many cultural differences in how the Russians and the Americans approach the world.
You've spent the last 6 years trying to get this glimpse of early Soviet life, but I also assume you had to immerse yourself in the current realities of Russia. What are some of the cultural and behavioral patterns that carry over, from that time till now?
You mean things that shock me?
Oh. Not necessarily, things that shock you and things that are persistent that may reappear, decades later.
Oh, you mean the way Russia doesn't really have much of respect for laws. It's very interesting because Americans are generally rule followers. If there's a rule, we don't even question it. We simply do it. We stand in line. We pick up our garbage. If there's a rule that says you need to have students do an evaluation, we don't even question it. We just hand out the student evaluation. I remember here for student evaluations, teachers were scandalized. The idea that students who didn't know anything would be evaluating them, it would turn the entire system on its head. And Russians like to get around laws that they find annoying or inconvenient. Part of it is just to think because to do things the correct way is often very difficult, if not impossible. There is, sometimes I'm reminded of the novel Catch-22 when I live in Russia because, you need the spravka to get this piece of paper, but to get the piece of paper,
you need a spravka.
Yep.
Now, one of the characteristics of contemporary Russia is how uneven its development is. You've got some regions like Kaluga, for example, where the local corruption has been brought to a minimum. But at the same time, you have regions in the Caucasus where you cannot do anything without the bribe. And that reminded me of the research you're involved in right now about the differences between the collective farms. And the idea that I got from your research is that what matters in Russia the most is not the ideological framework, but, the actual person in charge. Is that still the case?
In Russia, I think very much so. I think that personal networks are very important. I think, my students looking for jobs now, it's often more important who they know than the qualifications that they have. It's also, if you're friends with somebody, they maybe protect you. They help you get resources that you don't have access to. But, this sort of good old boys network exists in a lot of American small towns, too. And that's what it reminds me of, this good old boys network. And it's because the normal channels of communication often don't work. Certainly in the Soviet Union, the only way to get things done was to ask your friend who, paid someone with some volunteer to get you some seed. You see this most acutely during the war where you have shortages of everything. You have this barter system and the, Raikom chairman becomes sort of the go-to fixer for everybody.
One more parallel I found interesting was you mentioning that Stalin wanted to have this competent technocrats staffing the state system. And there is a similar desire on the part of the current Putin administration to have the technocrats in charge. But for some reason, neither the Stalin administration nor the Putin administration couldn't find enough of those people. Do you think they perhaps do they have a problem with the recruitment system, or do they run against this informal system of relationship that you mentioned?
In the Stalinist era, the level of education was a huge problem. You know, you have people that have, you know, I have one guy, he's the head of the district land organization in Zuzinski district. He's a chronic alcoholic with a second grade education. You know, at some level, you cannot expect competence from these people. Most people only had a elementary school education. Some people did have university, but it was very difficult. And so just getting the level of education up so that they could, deal with the volume of paperwork and just regular work that they were expected to do. They also expected an awful lot from these poor men. I feel deep, deep sympathy for my RICOM chairman, because they were expected to, organize harvests on the collective farm. They were expected to go out and do propaganda work. They were expected to study Leninism and Marxism. And they were expected to, have all of these different meetings. Some of these people had like 84 different meetings a month. They simply couldn't keep up. And I think that modern Russia faces a lot of the same problems, that you have chronic understaffing of a lot of bureaucracy. And even when you get staff, it just seems like it doesn't work particularly efficiently because of this desire to fill out all of this paperwork. With Soviet Union tried to fix things, a lot of the reforms involved more paperwork and more paperwork. And I think, this reliance on fixing things through paperwork reform is a problem that the Putin administration shares.
You said before that even at the height of totalitarianism, Russia was undergoverned. In other words, the central authority didn't have enough manpower, resources, technology. How much is that still an issue today?
I think it's a huge issue, particularly in provincial areas, because you have, I've been to villages where it feels like you've gone back into the 19th century. Some of them don't have electricity. Most of them don't have indoor running water or indoor plumbing. Healthcare, transport are all very difficult. If there's a bus, it's far away out on the road. It only comes occasionally. A lot of the roads are still mud.
Mm-hmm. Now, polls in Russia consistently show that people's attitudes towards Stalin are changing from overwhelmingly negative to more neutral and even positive. How do you interpret that?
Well, I think Russia took a real blow to its sense of self during the Yeltsin years. It lost a lot of power, a lot of prestige. The economy was terrible. And I think under Putin, Russia has sort of come back into a sense that it's a global player, that its voice matters. The economy has picked up. Russian people are becoming more proud of being Russian. I remember, even 6 years ago when I first came here, people kept apologizing to me for how terrible everything was, that this wasn't like America. And I had to finally tell them to stop. I'm like, I knew when I came here that this wasn't going to be like America. And that for me was weird, because Americans never apologize for our country. We're like, welcome to America, enjoy. And for people to be ashamed of their country was so different. And now I don't really see that. I see people are more proud of their country. And I think Putin has used Stalin, and particularly the Great Patriotic War and the victory there, as a way to inspire nationalistic pride.
Now, you said before that the Russian people are generally good at gaming or circumventing the system, and I wonder what's been your experience in dealing with the bureaucracy and the red tape, which I'm sure you've encountered here quite extensively.
I find it very frustrating. And it's often very counterintuitive for an American, because we're expecting that it should be easy. People should be helpful. If I have a problem, you shouldn't yell at me. You shouldn't send me to a different department. Things are very difficult to fix here. For example, I have two bank cards from Sberbank. One of them is issued to the name of Samantha Lam, without the H, and the other one is Samantha Ann Lam. And they cannot merge the two accounts because neither one is how it's written on my passport. Even though I have my passport, I'm clearly the same person. It's issued by the same organization, but they can't fix it. In the U.S., you would.
But since you've stayed here for such a long time, 6 years already, I assume that you perhaps also gotten into the habit of not skirting the rules, but perhaps being a little bit creative with how you apply them.
I am not sure that I've noticed it, but some of my friends have remarked that I have become bully-a-rusky.
But, the reason why I'm asking these questions is because obviously through the American perspective, this country may have major issues with corruption and its legal structure. I wonder what's your gut feeling about how to fix it. Do you think the American system would work in this country, or would Russians have to come with their own understanding of what the rule of law is? And would that understanding be different from...
Absolutely be different. You have a completely different history with the rule of law. I mean, Russia doesn't really have much in the way of rights, even citizens, or the rule of law up until about 1905, when you get the Tsar making some concessions. Then you have the Dumas, and I think you were moving towards the rule of law. You know, you have the establishment of an independent bar, you have, you know, elected representatives, even though the Tsar increasingly manipulated the franchise to get more and more conservative monarchists in the Duma. But then the Soviet Union blew that out of the water.
Even in your academic work, I think there is a bit more understanding of the complexities of this country than we would normally expect from American scholars, because some of them do come with the degree of what Russia is supposed to do and where it's failing. I wonder how challenging do you find this balance between looking at your own country and at this country with an open mind and, I guess, a degree of compassion?
I don't know that I find it challenging. Where it gets challenging is trying to get other people to listen to and accept your work. There are certain narratives that it's difficult to break out from. My work, you know, the idea that Stalin could have been interested in democracy has hit a wall with a lot of people. You know, see a lot of comments, you know, Stalin was a dictator, the USSR was totalitarian, it was really a ruse, look at the 1937 repression. And even, you know, within academia, there's this, you know, Putin is often a joke, this idea that he's some sort of evil dictator who oppresses his people.
It's not only in academia where she's challenged some conventions. Samantha's habit of walking her cat on a leash raised a few eyebrows, but the locals have quickly gotten used to the quirky American lady.
I certainly get a lot of attention, but most of it's positive. My neighbors think my cats are pretty. I get asked lots of questions about them.
How difficult was it for you to adjust to your life, not just in Russia, but in, you know, in provincial Russia, which has its own challenges?
The first 6 months were really kind of hard, in part because I was alone in the dormitory. Once I got a cat and start making friends, and I had people to meet for tea or to go visit their house.
Пожалуйста, проходите. No.
It was fine. In many ways, it's not that much different from my hometown. I came from a little town where there were more cows than people. And I sort of like the slower pace of life. Mm-hmm.
The relationship between Russia and the United States got from mediocre to bad to worse, I think, over the last 5 or 6 years. Have you noticed any difference in how people relate to you, how they treat you?
No, not really. I think Russians are pretty good at delineating the actions of a government and the actions of citizens. Every now and then, for example, on Victory Day, when we talk about who won the war, I get some pushback. You know, they ask me, did America say we won the war? Of course we said we won the war. It's our textbook. But then, you know, there's some pushback because, of course, the Soviet losses were far greater and people are very proud of their relatives that served and died. I realize that there is, you know, a great pride in this and that the Soviet Union sacrifice was big, but most Americans probably don't. And so some issues like that, I've noticed some more pushback. But overall, most people know me. Most people are very friendly.
Do you ever find yourself in a position of having to explain, condemn, or defend the actions of the American government? Because I think there is a tendency in Russia to sort of treat or perceive every American as the representative of the United States responsible for the policies of the country.
Well, my students know that I'm not a particularly large Trump fan. So sometimes they will ask me about his policies, I think, just to see my reaction. But for the most part, no. Most people are pretty good about realizing that I'm not responsible for the actions of my government.
Mm-hmm. Do you even follow the American politics these days?
I do, Because, you know, my family still lives there. I still have interests in the U.S. Most of it makes me sad, to be perfectly honest.
One endearing thing that I noticed in how you describe this region, Vyatka, in your English language interviews is that you use a lot of collective pronouns, we and ours. And that sounds very sweet, but I wonder if this place really feel like home to you, or maybe second home.
It does. I've been here 6 years. I'm very fond of Kirov. The people are wonderful. When we aren't under, 4 feet of snow, the region is very beautiful.
But there's, we talked about it before, there's a lot of red tape. There's also a lot of unnecessary hurdles and hustles, I assume, in your life.
Every day, pretty much not, because I've gotten through a lot of those. They are annoying when they crop up, but they're rare. And I really enjoy my students. My kids are wonderful.
Do you think Russia and the United States can ever get along on a state level rather than personal one?
I hope so, but I think a lot of people have a vested interest in the U.S. having an enemy, and currently Russia is the most viable enemy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it perhaps works both ways on both sides of the ocean.
Yeah.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.